The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Transmission of Light, Dogen. Dogen's study was Zen Master Ruijing. Once during meditation, sitting late at night, Ruijing said to the assembly, "Zen study is a shedding of mind and body." Hearing this, suddenly Dogen was greatly enlightened. He went right to the abbot's room and lit incense. Ruijing asked him, "What are you burning incense for?" Dogen said, "My body and mind have been shed." Ruijing said, "Body and mind shed, shed, body and mind." Dogen said, "This is a temporary byway. Don't approve me arbitrarily." Ruijing said, "I'm not." Dogen said, "What is that which isn't given arbitrary approval?" Ruijing said, "Shedding body and mind." Dogen bowed. Ruijing said, "The shedding is shed." At that time, Ruijing's attendant said, "This is no small matter that a foreigner has attained such a state." Ruijing said, "How many times has he been pummeled here, liberated, dignified, thunder roars?" Kazon's verse. Clear as pure light, no inside or outside. Is there any body or mind to be shed? Character for shedding here can mean dropping off, forgetting, casting away. So shedding body and mind, what is it that shed? We have a physical body, we have mind. Are they the same? Are they different? Dada Roshi brought body practice as a deliberate and particular aspect of our training here, one of the eight gates. And he spoke of it as the miracle of aliveness, which I've always liked a lot. The miracle of aliveness. In the eight gates, Dada Roshi says, body practice is not exercise. It's not martial arts or aerobics, jogging or pumping iron. Body practice is nothing other than washing the face, cleaning the body, it's urination, elimination, cooking food, eating a meal, healing sickness, actualizing birth, practicing life, realizing death. Only when this is understood can we begin to speak of martial arts, aerobics, pumping iron. Body practice is concerned with self-realization through the body. It is realizing that this body is the body of the Buddha, the body of this entire universe. One of the things we realize when we come into practice is that practice is a very body thing. Right? We use it. The first thing happens is we're taught Zazen to take a posture, to turn inward. In Dogen's Fascicle on Body-Mind Study of the Way, he wrote, "To study the way with the body means to study the way with your own body. You can't use somebody else's. And you can't use yours until you fully inhabit yours, or to some reasonable degree. It's the study of the way using this lump of red flesh. The body comes forth from the study of the way." So as we practice, the body becomes revealed through the Dharma. The Dharma, our Dharma study, reveals the body. All that it is, all else it is, and also what it isn't. Everything that comes forth from the study of the way is the true human body. The entire world of the ten directions is nothing but this true human body. The coming and going of birth and death is a true human body. It can't be known apart from the body. That's why Buddhism, Buddha Dharma, is very specifically about the human world, the human realm, the human life, the human body and mind. To turn the body around, abandon the 10 unwholesome actions, keep the 8 precepts, take refuge in the 3 treasures, leave home and enter the homeless life. This is the true study of the way. And for this reason, it's called the true human body. Those who follow this must not be like outsiders who hold the view of spontaneous enlightenment. I was listening to a teacher recently who said that in Tibetan Buddhism, Tibetans tend not to say, "I am a Tibetan Buddhist." But they use a word that says, essentially, "I am an insider," which doesn't mean, you know, insider is part of an elite group, but rather, "I'm not an outsider. I'm not going out seeking. I'm an insider." As this teacher said, it's an inside job. This true human body, is that your physical body, your emotional body, psychological, spiritual body? Is it the skandhas? Is it the body of emptiness? Well, what would you leave out? If we want to be free in this world, that means being free in this life, which means being free in this body and mind. So what would we leave out or deny? You know, when we're first introduced to Zazen, I first learned it from a book back, because that's all I knew there was. But to actually be given instruction, in fact, the first time I came here was sitting in the Zendo on a Sunday morning. Kyoto, the head monk, when they made the announcement for beginning instruction, came up to me, tapped me on the shoulder, said, "Don't you need beginning instruction?" I said, "No, I'm good."
Arrogant.
I did not know what I did not know. But then when we're receiving this instruction, we shouldn't underestimate the posture, taking the posture of a Buddha, sitting on the seat, the diamond seat. This posture, which is a body of wisdom, which is sort of tapping into our own intelligence, our own sort of perfectness within this body, that allows the body to find stability more than we can imagine, aliveness more than we can imagine, an openness of pathways more than we can imagine, a leaping beyond this very body itself more than we can imagine. And just these basic elements of sitting upright, that you hold up your own weight. You know, we can think of these things, I did, as just, you know, sort of physical manifestations, like do this, do this, do this, without any sense of, you know, that it's connected. It's part, it's an expression of a basic wisdom and intelligence, a Buddha Dharma in this body. And the Zazen is a pathway, which means that pathway has to get opened, right? And what we encounter when we Zazen is all of the pathways that are not open. Those are our struggles. And it is also at the very moment that it is a pathway, the thing itself, the very thing that we're seeking. Sitting upright, facing forward. It's not a retreat. It's not an escape. Senses are open. It's not a withdrawal. Alert and relaxed. Sounds good. Not so easy. Not so easy because we're not relaxed. We're not alert. Awake. The body sits Zazen, but you don't sit in this body. You don't sit apart from it. The body knows. It's really turning towards the body's intrinsic wisdom. It knows. Things arise. And we practice not naming, not denying, not indulging, not distracting, not clinging. We turn our attention to the breath. We follow the breath. Where is it going? We speak of being the breath. Have you ever been apart from it? Turn this body around, Dogen says. Don't be an outsider. Looking at it objectively, Zazen, is very simple. It's not complicated. And if we have the basic physical, mental, emotional ability to do Zazen, then it means we have that at the very beginning. So why is it so difficult? Thoughts arise, emotions come and go. They seem to occur within this body. We experience thoughts in our mind. Energy. We begin to encounter, for lack of a better word, energy. Ki, aliveness, spirit. Something is moving. We can feel it in our eyes, our throat, chest. In large part in the beginning, it's a tangle. It's like a log jam. It's all tangled up. And so we experience it as a tangle, bound, uncomfortable. It may be strong, it may be weak, it can come and go. It can be tense, it can be relaxed. It's one of the really important aspects of sitting still and actually experiencing all of those fluctuations, all of those movements. That in so many moments, we would just simply rather not, if you don't mind. But there they are. So we're beginning introduced to this body-mind, seeing how they arise together. It's interesting over the years how many people have come through here who have spent much of their lives in their body doing different forms of yoga practice or martial arts or sports. People in the military who have done really impressive things with their body, right? That required all kinds of abilities, capacities, skill, courage. And yet something about sitting on this simple mat and going inside, it's not like others. I've seen people who have done genuinely heroic, courageous things in their life become weak-kneed, fearful, reluctant, hesitant, just starting to turn inside. To realize the self through the body, if we identify ourselves as anything, it's the body. Right? Why do we cling to it so much as it ages? Why does society or people in society invest so much in the perfect body? The body that if you had, everything would be great. You would be happy forever. Everyone would love you. And what happens when we start to age? And that body begins to age as it must. Because that's part of its intelligence, it's part of its wisdom. It follows the natural laws. How do we feel about that? We feel our emotions, sensations, everything within our body, but where are they? Can you find them? Dada Roshi says, self-realization needs to be with our whole being. Unfortunately, the search for self-knowledge is usually regarded as purely a function of the intellect. Feeling and intuition are largely considered to be subjective and therefore unreliable instruments for realizing truth. Yet by reducing the search for truth to an intellectual activity, we achieve only a distorted understanding of who we really are and of what's possible. Body, mind have fallen away, shed, body and mind. I came across an article by a scholar who said that Ruijing never actually used the term body-mind. They can't find it in any of his writings or any of his successors' writings. Only Dogen. It's only found in Dogen's teaching. And that the word for body-mind is a homophone for the word in Chinese for dust. And that what is found in the teachings of Ruijing is he talked about the dust of the mind, the dust from the mind. And so the scholar speculates that Dogen misheard. And Ruijing was actually talking about dust, but Dogen heard it as body-mind. So he says Dogen must have misheard this term due to a lack of full comprehension of Chinese, intuitively misrepresenting it or purposefully changing it. Which doesn't really matter, right? Because even if he heard it correctly, but then through his own experience, experienced body-mind shed, which is clearly what he experienced, and was not based on a correct or incorrect interpretation of a character or word that his teacher had said. Every person has their own direct experience. And what, you know, part of training is to in a sense, test that with the Dharma. I mean, everybody who practices is having experiences all the time, right? Just ordinary experiences. Because we're having perceptions. Our senses are picking up. We're in a body. Things are happening. We're aware of them. So we're having experiences. But in terms of insights, deeper experiences. There are all kinds of experiences that can be had that are had, but are they in alignment with the Buddha Dharma, which really means, are they helping you to awaken? Because we can have lots of experiences that might be quite wonderful, enlivening, inspiring, but they're not really helping us to awaken. And so part of training is to get clear about that. One's own body, which is the body of the universe, this body which is not yours, it's not something, it's your true body, your reality body. It's neither absolute nor relative body. It's not this, it's not this body. This is the body to be realized. The entire world of the 10 directions, Dogen says, means that all 10 directions are the entire world. To consider, he says, consider the moment when front and back, vertical and horizontal, are thoroughly reached. East, west, south, north, the four midpoints, up and down, the 10 directions, front and back, vertical and horizontal. Consider this. He's basically talking about all of space. And then he says, to consider this means to understand and to resolve that this human body, undivided by self and others, is the entire world of the 10 directions. This is to hear what has never been heard. And so think about in the Metta Sutta, when the Buddha said, even as a mother protects her life, with her life, her child, her only child, in the same way with a boundless heart should we cherish all living beings, radiating kindness, where? Over the entire world, upwards to the skies, downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded. It's exactly what Dogen is saying. And that's a meditation. In this case, a meditation of cultivating metta, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. But it's not just having a feeling. It's bringing forth that within the body, letting it infuse the body, all throughout the body, and then letting that body become the body of the universe. So how do we practice that? By extending with our mind that quality, that characteristic in those directions. Upwards to the skies, downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded. All four directions. And when the mind enters into that spaciousness, the body has to, at the same time, be spacious. And so then the body becomes a body of loving kindness. The universe becomes a universe of loving kindness in that moment. It's not you. It's not apart from you. When it is undivided, it's not something that you're doing. It's just loving kindness. Cast off. So when we begin practicing that and it feels wobbly or distracted or tight or diminished, or it's not that the loving kindness itself is diminished. It's not that the body is limited in some way. It's that that symphony of body and mind working as one. You know, the teachings say that when the body, when the mind, and whenever we think of mind, we have to think of body at the same time. If we talk about body, we have to think of mind at the same time. Because we have inherited, right, an attitude, a view of the world in which these are separated. So you can be a mind person, you can be a body person. But then when we're practicing this, we could think of it as reclaiming or just coming back to experiencing that body, that true human body, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing, walking, seated, lying down, freed from drowsiness, sustain that recollection, sustain that mind. This is the sublime abiding, the Buddha said. My body and mind have been shed, Dogen said, dropped off, cast away, which in a sense is just the limitation of language, right? If the body and mind was something you could put your fingers on and cast away, we would have all done it, right? If it was a thing that had a place of its thingness, a location, and we could locate it and we could grab it because it's a thing, that's what you can do with things, and then we put it somewhere, we'd all be enlightened. And so to even say, my body and mind have been shed, is really just to say, body and mind are liberated. And it's interesting how in this dialogue, Dogen says, when Ruijing affirms this, body and mind have been shed. And Dogen says, hang on, this is just a temporary byway. Don't approve me arbitrarily. He wanted to be sure. He clearly had some surety because he goes into the abbot's room and lights incense, and Ruijing says, what are you doing? But he wants to be sure. He wants his teacher to be sure, so that he can be sure. So he says, don't approve me arbitrarily. Ruijing says, I'm not. And of course, remember that they have been training together. That Ruijing gave him, I don't know if it was unprecedented, but it was a very unusual invitation, particularly somebody who had just come in. And he said, you can come to my abbot's room anytime. An open invitation. So it wasn't that he was just hearing this from Dogen for the first time and affirming him. He knew Dogen. So he said, this isn't arbitrary. What is it that you are not giving arbitrarily, shedding body and mind? And Dogen bowed, and Ruijing said, now, the shedding itself is shed. When we first come into practice, for the most part, I think we know that we have a body, right? That's how we got here. And in a sense, we begin to experience its miracles, if they don't feel quite miraculous yet. We begin to thaw what is frozen, to come into contact with what has been numb, to begin to accept what has been denied, to let go of the idea of the perfect or imperfect body, which means the perfect or imperfect mind, which means the perfect or imperfect self. to let go of what we identify as with body and mind, and then to let go of letting go, freed from hatred and ill will towards others, towards ourself. Hatred can only occur within a very solid body and mind that is frozen, that is numb in that moment, certainly towards the object of our hatred. But necessarily, because this body is the body and mind of the universe, towards oneself. One's own body has to be frozen, numbed, in order to freeze another, hate another. But because by that time we have almost certainly adapted to that frozen body-mind, and not just adapted to it, but identified with it, quite possibly turned it into something quite productive, quite successful. Rewards. When we free that, then we begin to experience the miracle of dignity, beauty, fragility, resilience, strength, intelligence, suffering. To really experience suffering. Right? We don't really expect that that's part of the deal. Right? To be free from suffering means that every sequential step to be moving further and further away from it. Sorry. It's actually moving closer and closer because it's an inside thing. But so to be able to experience that within this body freely, giving it passage, just like everything else. And to really, the miracle of this body, which is not dependent upon size or shape or color or age or ability, but it has to be fully attuned or attuning to those things, which becomes quite important when we're sick, when we've been injured, when we're getting older, when we're getting frail, when we have an illness, and the body is not, does not move the way it did yesterday, cannot do what it did yesterday. That might be temporary, it might be ongoing. This week in conversations and communication and doksans, it's like, okay, the Sangha is aging. She's had repeated contacts with people who either they themselves or their partners or somebody in their family is experiencing sickness, old age, and death. And even though we have been practicing for years and years, still when it really comes home, when we really begin to experience, it can be a little bit of a surprise. Because there's the idea, right, of sickness, old age, and death, and then there's being sick. Right? There's the idea of aging. I mean, when I was younger, I had all kinds of ideas of aging. I would look at older people and think, what's with you anyway? Why can't you, you know, stand up straight, you know, walk fast, you know? It seemed like a choice, right? Arrogant. It becomes real. And so where is the miracle of aliveness now? When it can is not and cannot be dependent on those conditions because they're changing. Dogen said, to bow all the way to the floor and to bow standing is dignified bearing in motion and stillness. Painting a decayed tree, polishing a brick of dead ash, continues without stopping, playing freely with the true body. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down. And so we practice cultivating, coming into contact with, enlivening the miracle of aliveness as we sit, as we walk, as we eat, as we clean, as we work, as we bow. It's a fundamental practice. And every so often, usually a fairly new student will come in and say, okay, now what? I got this, but now what? Start over. Or start for the first time, maybe. Because the thing is we can't experience the miraculousness until we do. And so until then, what we have to know is our actual experience, which feels some version of limited, confined, not miraculous. And that's why these teachings are so important. That we keep hearing these teachings, which are reports from inside. And it's like, okay, I hear what you're saying. You're making it very sort of robust and describe this. You're using imagery. It's like I can visualize it, but I don't know that. That is not my experience. That's the point, is to hear that as a calling, an invitation. So that when we enter into these basic fundamental practices for the rest of our lives, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, bowing, eating, urinating, defecating, working, we're on an endless path of endlessly entering in more deeply, because our imagination cannot provide for us the sort of imagined reality of that. You know, the level of our awareness at any moment reveals to us. It's like I was saying to somebody earlier, we open our eyes and it's like, I'm seeing everything there is to see in this room. Seems like it. Am I? When we turn our attention inward and I have awareness of what I see, it's like I am aware of everything there is to see. No. No. It's like, okay, I hear you saying that, and so I can try and imagine, and usually what I'll imagine is some version of, you know, fantastical, magical, supernatural something. No. And so that's why hearing these teachings, and then it's like these teachings are intended to make you hungry, hungrier. I don't think I've tasted that yet, but I want to. Kazan said, reaching this point, when you observe closely, even if you use 1,000 eyes, you do not find a particle of anything that can be called skin, flesh, bones, marrow. There's nothing to divide into mind, cognition, consciousness. How can you know coolness and warmth? How can you distinguish pain and itch when the body is the body of the universe? There is no distinguishing. What would you affirm or deny? What like or dislike? This is why it has been said, when you see, there's not a single thing. And so he's speaking about that mind, your natural mind, but isn't he also at the same time telling you how to do zazen, right? So when you are sitting, don't divide your mind, your body, cognition, consciousness. Don't separate coolness and warmth. Don't grab onto one and reject the other. Don't, with everything that arises, choose it or reject it. Don't like or dislike. Let all of those impulses calm. And so then, Dada Roshi says, as we're practicing this, then we can really begin to understand these forms of body practice. Qigong, Tai Chi, yoga, dance, running, pumping iron. I don't even know if they still call it that. But most importantly, we practice it through the everyday ordinary movements. Because if we're not doing that, then those other forms, it's not that they can't open that up for us, but they'll be restricted. And so when cooking and sweeping a floor and cleaning a bathroom and driving a car and holding a baby, sounds like caretaking, sounds like work practice, sounds like a unified life. I was thinking about, I was talking at breakfast with some folks, and you know, like when they were talking about, when the president administration was talking about closing down the parks. And I thought, the people who are thinking this way, do you ever go outside? Do your feet ever touch the ground? Do you stand in the presence of a tree? Have you felt the miracle of what is not human, but can be known within your human body? I hear Elon Musk talk about, you know, AI and how that's going to save the world, and we just need to get to Mars. Then it's like, okay, now it makes sense what you're doing. We don't matter. Doesn't matter. This Earth doesn't matter. Machines matter. What kind of frozenness? What kind of outsider? What kind of mind and body are not one is that? And how the more pronounced that becomes, the more estranged, not just from others, the earth, but ourselves. In a sense, all things become possible in the worst way possible. And the sort of the hard thing about it is if we can't know something until we experience something. So even to come into practice and be drawn by the teachings, the reports from within that I have not experienced, but when I hear those, they're touching something in me. The affinity is not over here, it's here. So even if I haven't experienced that directly, if it's not really clear to me, something is being touched. Something is alive. And if I don't experience that, at least in that moment, something is not. There is no affinity. There is no contact. There is no calling. And so that's why the way we sit is so important. You know, we're training in each moment, not just to calm our minds, but the whole body. And so to be upright, alert, which means there is a kind of effort, which is actually very important. It's not passive. It's not, not me, not now. It's not, mine. It's a middle way. It's a middle way, which isn't a balance, although balance is good. It's something that has to be discovered and cultivated and loved. It's sort of, I think, of how, you know, as Sesshin goes on, even, you know, more beginning students sometimes will say this, everybody becomes more and more beautiful. What's happening there? So I want to end with this miracle of aliveness with a poem by Walt Whitman. Why? Who makes much of a miracle? As to me, I know of nothing else but miracles. Whether I walk the streets of Manhattan, or dart my sight over the roofs of houses toward the sky, or wade with naked feet along the beach just in the edge of the water, or stand under trees in the woods, or talk by day with anyone I love, or sleep in the bed at night with anyone I love, or sit at table at dinner with the rest, or look at strangers opposite me riding in the car, or watch honeybees busy around the hive of a summer forenoon, or animals feeding in the fields, or birds, or the wonderfulness of insects in the air, or the wonderfulness of the sundown, or of stars shining so quiet and bright, or the exquisite, delicate, thin curve of the new moon in spring. These, with the rest, one and all, are to me miracles. the whole referring, yet each distinct and in its place. To me, every hour of the light and dark is a miracle. Every cubic inch of space is a miracle. Every square yard of the surface of the earth is spread with the same. Every foot of the interior swarms with the same. To me, the sea is a continual miracle. The fishes that swim, the rocks, the motion of the waves, the ships with men in them. What stranger miracles are there?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.